Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Nathan Beckard. Nathan is founder and CEO of FounderSuite, a platform that helps entrepreneurs source and update investors, as well as run an efficient fundraise. He's been working in and around the startup ecosystem in the West Coast and Bay Area for more than 20 years, and as a consultant has helped ventures raise over $200 million at seed and Series A. Over $3 billion has been collectively raised on FounderSuite. Nathan, welcome to the podcast. It's absolutely wonderful to have you here with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited about this show.
Amazing. So let's dive right in. You've been in the valley since the dot-com bubble burst back in the late 90s, early 2000s, right the way through to today. And for many of our audience, this side of the pond in the UK and Europe, it would be great if you could talk us through how the ecosystem has evolved over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, it's almost kind of weird to even think it's been two decades, because I don't feel like it's been, you know, it feels like it's been about 5 years, but it's been two decades I've been out there. I went to college out in Silicon Valley, Santa Clara University, which is kind of right in the middle. Then right afterwards, graduated and went to work in investment banking up in San Francisco. And this is right in the late 90s, right as the dot-com bubble was exploding. And it was a crazy time. I mean, the Silicon Valley had been very entrepreneurial, right? It was the hub of Intel, Hewlett Packard, Apple, Oracle, right? I mean, there are Applied Materials. There's always tech companies, big enterprise tech companies that had grown up in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And then in the late 90s, you know, dot-com boom, where everyone's got a startup. So it had this like crazy intense energy for about 3 years. And then it just crashed. I remember in March of 2000, you know, when the NASDAQ crashed, and there was a waiting list for like 6 months to get out of Silicon Valley. So it really crashed hard when it crashed, and people predicted Silicon Valley's dead, right? I've heard Silicon Valley's over, it's done. I've heard that phrase every 6 years for 20 years, right? You know, but within like a couple years of the dot-com bust, things were starting to happen again, right? You had LinkedIn and other startups that were kind of starting to be formed. Facebook moved out from Boston to Silicon Valley and others, and you started to have this second wave, you know, and then we had our 2008 financial crisis, which also kind of crashed things down. But it's been really interesting, because it's, I feel like, you know, to answer your question more directly, the tempo of startup creation has kind of increased. The cycle time has maybe shortened a bit. And partly that's, I think, because of technology, right? Like, it's easier to start a startup nowadays with Amazon Cloud and all the no-code tools. Back in the, you know, old days, you had to raise $5-10 million just to like build your first product, right? Whereas nowadays, you can really get a startup launched on $100,000 or whatever, you know. And so I think the cycle of innovation creation is accelerated. And of course, you know, now with COVID, I mean, people left Silicon Valley again. We've had this story again where people are leaving Silicon Valley, but really, I'm pretty long-term bullish, just because there's so much tech and talent here, right? You've got very few places else in the world can you find a pool of talent that can scale a company from zero to 200 million in 3 years. Those people are here, right? In Austin, there may be two people with that knowledge, but and you know, in other places, there are a few people, but here it's like a dense ecosystem. So that hasn't changed. I think that's a pretty long-term thing. You know, it's fun though. It's fun. It's fun to watch these cycles over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that is really, you know, as you were speaking, that really came to mind was, you know, you said Silicon Valley's done every 6 years, or people kind of herald the end of Silicon Valley every 6 years. Like, at the moment, there's a massive kind of trend, certainly on Twitter, if not in real life, for, you know, advocates for Miami over Silicon Valley. But I think to your point, right? Talent flows where capital is, and capital flows where talent is. And as long as you retain that kind of density of talent, you will have that density of capital as well. And those two things kind of go hand in hand, and both are necessary for a really great startup ecosystem to thrive. And just the number of businesses that are out there just means that, you know, there is talent both coming to join those businesses, but equally that talent also is already there in those businesses and is mobile, right? So they are moving from company to company or setting up their own companies as they, you know, maybe vest their shares or vest their equity and, you know, are able to then sort of start up or even invest themselves, as has become, you know, even more prevalent. So one of the questions I had, like, you've worked on all sides of the ecosystem, but I would love to understand, you know, some of the challenges that you personally have faced as a founder yourself, and which side of the table do you prefer, operating or investing? And is Founder Suite, as an example, is that a way that you found to satisfy both of those roles or both of those kind of personalities within yourself?
Yeah, I'll jump right to that question. I love operating and building startups way more than investing or fundraising for startups, doing investment banking, which is what I started with. It's so much harder. It's more stressful. Like, I look like I'm 80 years old, even though I'm not. I'm 50. And that's because the startup lifestyle is grueling and it's going to age you pretty rapidly. That's, you know, just something you have to accept. But it's so much more fun. I mean, my story very in a nutshell is I worked in investment banking, helping companies raise capital, then went out on my own and was doing that for about 10 years, and then had this idea of building software for raising capital, which is where Founder Suite was born over 6 years ago. So we're kind of in the third act here, or third decade of this. And it's so much more fun to build products, even though, you know, you've got to deal with angry customers and bugs and the site crashes because you forgot to renew your DNS domain thing or something, right? I mean, there's always like something you don't foresee. And but to your other question, yeah, Founder Suite is very much a way to stay involved in fundraising, which I love. I think it's really fun. You know, I'm a capitalist by heart. I'm a finance guy by heart. And, you know, when I was in college, I thought I was really attracted to this idea of, you know, helping capital flow where it has the best return, right? And that's kind of, you know, what capital markets do. And I thought that was really sexy and attractive. And it is, I still think it is. And now I'm facilitating that in a slightly different way by providing the tools that help founders who are, you know, have good companies raise capital faster, more efficiently. So definitely gets to scratch both those itches. But to the point, it's so much more fun to be a startup operator founder than investment banking or investing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think almost every operator I've spoken to says that they love operating. Most of the investors I speak to kind of fall on both sides, right? Like, I think there is a lot of glamour around VC and even kind of, you know, we have this sort of cult of founder. And at the moment, there's a lot of stories, whether it's Fast or whether it's Hopin. There's been a bunch of kind of startup really that have scaled really quickly, especially over the pandemic, which have kind of fallen from grace. But the interesting thing is that is part and parcel of kind of the venture game, right? Like, these businesses are fueled to the extent where it is go big or go home. And, you know, unfortunately, more often than not, venture-backed businesses do go home. You know, the numbers don't lie. One of the things, though, you know, I'd love to understand is, you know, you mentioned, okay, yes, obviously the obvious things around not renewing your domain or something kind of glitching in one of the features, or effectively a client expecting something that maybe isn't part of the product suite. But what, like, have you had any kind of really substantial challenges? Because one of the things that I think is really interesting is that to be a great founder, you have to wear many, many hats, right? But the biggest hat of all is sales, right? So it's whether you're selling to investors, whether you're selling to employees, whether you're selling to your customers, right? And I think one of the places that a lot of founders fall down over is that they're not great salespeople. You've obviously had experience both on the investment side as well as now, you know, the operating and founding side. But like, were there substantial challenges getting off? Or as I often find, as someone who advises other businesses, it's harder to take my own advice than it is to give it out. So kind of what did you find like in terms of challenges in founding Founder Suite?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Geez. I mean, we could spend hours on the challenges, but I'll summarize into a couple of key ones. You know, so when I started Founder Suite, I had been raising capital for startups for many years. And just like what you said, I actually found it easier to help advise companies raising capital than to go do it ourselves. When I went out to raise our seed round, I actually failed twice. I went out and talked to a bunch of investors, got no interest, went back to the drawing board, went back and just worked on product for 6 months, went back again, failed again. And then it was the third try, was able to successfully raise money. Now, what I actually haven't talked about very much is we raised some money, raised $1 million, went and used that to just completely rebuild the product from the ground up, which had to happen because the MVP was crap. You know, it was built very quickly and wasn't scalable, right? So we used the money to rebuild the product and hired a development team and all that stuff. And then by the time I was out, finished with that money, it basically spent all the money to rebuild the product, our traction really wasn't high enough, or we weren't growing fast enough. Our revenue wasn't growing fast enough to be able to raise more money. So we're kind of in that valley of death that a lot of startups fall into, like, you know, sort of that seed crunch. People call it seed crunch, in between the seed and Series A. We didn't have the right metrics to go raise money, but we were kind of out of money. And I had to let go almost everyone. We got down to like 3 people, barely running on. We actually got in negative where the company owed more money than we had money in the bank for a few months. And that's, of course, scary. But then very slowly, things kind of started to turn around. And we started to, you know, our monthly revenue increased a little bit every month. And after almost 6 months of having almost no engineering team, was able to start to hire again. And then, you know, very slowly kind of got back our momentum and rhythm and everything else. And we've since been profitable pretty much every month for the past like 3 or 4 years. So basically we died. You know, we were kind of on like life support slash death and just barely hung on and, you know, have since turned it into a success. And now we're up to 15 people and growing pretty nicely. But that was extremely stressful, right? This was my baby. This was my startup this was my one shot. I knew how to raise capital. I built software for Reason Capital. If this thing didn't go and it failed, I don't have a plan B. I have no other startup ideas. I don't have any job prospects. I mean, I'm sure I could have found something, but you know, there was no plan B, right? So if this lifeboat sinks, I'm basically dead. And that's a lot of pressure for anyone, I think. You know, I'm glad the story worked out, but I think, I guess the moral of that story is you're going to find, as any founder, those moments where it seems like it's over, it's done, you know, but those are the people that just get back up the next morning and write another line of code or make another sales call or whatever it is, make another investor call, and they keep it going, right? Those are the founders that kind of make it in the end and, you know, that I love. So anyway, did I even answer your question?
Yeah, no, I think you really did. I mean, like that, just what you were saying at the end there reminds me of, I don't know if it's Naval who said this, but it feels like something he might have said, but it may well also have been the bot that kind of replicates what he says. But it was something along the lines of, you know, businesses don't fail because they run out of cash. They fail because the founder runs out of momentum, right?
Yep.
And I think that's a really poignant kind of thing to think about. There is always a way to like go out, consult, you know, bootstrap yourself back to a place where you can, you know, you can try again, but you can only do that if you have the will to actually carry on, right? Whereas there are plenty of founders. I'm sure there are many founders out there that get to a stage where they just think, you know, actually, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this to myself. I can't do it to my family. I can't do it, you know, to my employees or whoever it might be. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that per se, but it is that massive kind of difference in tenacity and in, you know, chutzpah and really just like kind of the real kind of resilience, I guess is probably the best word, of the great founders to kind of carry on in despite adversity. One thing that I really loved is, you know, you raised money, you developed the product, but then you got to a point where you couldn't raise the additional money or the traction wasn't there. But you didn't quit, right? You carried on. And this is, I think, the thing that too many founders aren't good at, realizing that actually my runway is not going to take me forward. I need to cut costs. I need to, however hard it is, I need to release that engineer or the product person or the salesperson or whoever it might be, right? Because ultimately, you know, if cash is the lifeblood of a business, right, the more you can retain or the more you can conserve it, right, the more likelihood there is of future success. So I think, you know, the message that I'd love to get across to our listeners and certainly to founders out there is, you know, those hard decisions are the right decisions, right? Because it is pointless you having a venture that survives another 3 months because you've retained all your staff, where, you know, potentially you may be able to, you know, extend your runway out to 6 or 12 months, get yourself back in a place where you've got the capital to be able to go out and hire those people back and you can hire more and bigger and better. And the other thing I'd say, you know, you mentioned earlier you're 50, I'm 43, I think. I keep forgetting. I think I've lost the last couple of years. I think there is also something that comes with kind of maturity and also having seen a lot of these scenarios play out in various different ways that gives you, I guess, a little bit of that perspective to be able to do that. And again, you know, without beating on it, you know, the stories are, you know, Hopin, I think there was an article in the FT that, you know, they've just released, I think, 12% of their staff.
Wow. Yeah. You
know, it's about 120 odd people, I think. And obviously the big story was Fast, where literally they went from 500 to no employees because they
That was
they
a shocking one. Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. But look, I'd love to actually understand how the product works. Like, who mm-hmm. is it for? Why did you think it was really important to build it right now? Because I think there's, you know, there's a lot of people out there that, you know, in inverted commas, fundraise, right? They're brokers and they try and kind of match capital to ventures. I always have this slight opinion that for anything that is truly venture backable, if you need a broker to find the capital, the likelihood is it's not venture backable. Mm-hmm. And then you have platforms like in the UK, Cedars and Crowdcube, and US firm has just bought out Cedars, actually, and the name just escapes me. But, you know, that are the crowdfunding platforms that effectively are for, you know, good businesses, but not necessarily, you know, venture backable businesses. So I'd love to understand more about Founder Suite and how it works and who it's for.
Sure. So it goes back to when I was doing investment banking and then went out and hung out my own shingle as a consultant. I was doing this for early stage companies, helping them raise their seed Series A rounds. If you were a startup and you came to me, you know, we had a pretty formulaic process. First, we would help you develop your pitch deck. We would help you build your financial forecast. And then we would go and research and build you a target list of investors, maybe 50, 100, 200 investors, load them all up into this fancy spreadsheet that had, you know, different columns. And then we would hand that to you and you would use that spreadsheet to really track all your discussions with investors. And that worked okay. The problem with the spreadsheet was that, you know, if you're talking to 100 or 200 investors, that spreadsheet becomes really unwieldy and messy in about 2 weeks or less. And it's hard to track 200 conversations in a spreadsheet. So our first product was our investor CRM. And so this is a like a Kanban board. It's a pipeline management tool. So each investor is represented by a little card and you're moving these cards around your column as you're making progress with them, you know, from contact to pitch to diligence to committed, right? You're kind of moving all these cards around your board, tracking all the activities and tasks and to-dos and emails and files and all that stuff, right? So that was what we launched with 6 years ago. And that's still kind of our flagship product. And really the value prop there is, like I said, you're talking to 200 investors. Every time you talk to an investor, it's probably going to lead to a couple follow-up action items. And you got to stay on top of all that stuff, or your fundraising is going to kind of stagnate and slip through, things will slip through the cracks. You need to never be the bottleneck as the founder when you're raising capital. Things have to be moving fast. One of the things I tell founders all the time is, you know, there's a direct correlation between kind of the tempo and speed of your fundraise and the likelihood you are to get a check at the end. And so you want things to be moving fast, and that's where a CRM like our product, or, you know, people use other stuff too, really comes into play. But then we've basically been launching another product or two every year. So we launched a database of investors to help you build that target list. Pretty natural evolution there. And we've now got about 200,000 investors in there. Angels, VCs, private equity, family offices, fund to funds, LPs, kind of the whole spectrum. And then we launched an investor update tool. And that's for doing your ongoing, you know, monthly, quarterly updates to investors, both the people who write you a check and the prospective investors. We launched a pitch deck hosting tool. So it's kind of like Google Slides or DocSend, where you can, you know, upload your pitch deck, send it out, see who views it. We added email tools for doing like follow-up at scale. We added a document collection, pitch decks, term sheets. And then most recently, we added a virtual data room. So as you get into, you know, due diligence and deeper discussions with investors, this is where you can share all your confidential information, you know, designate who can access what, who can download, who can print. And it's, of course, tracking all that activity. So, you know, if you kind of think about it, it's this end-to-end suite of tools kind of matching each step in the funding process. So that's it.
Yeah, I mean, as someone, again, who's been both sides of that table, like, I think that's a really compelling service solution. Like, I mean, ultimately, A, the data is now that, you know, warm introductions are no longer like necessary, but at the same time, it's still hard to get the contact details or understand who the investors are, or even be able to search, you know, organically. Like if I go to Google and search for VCs in the UK, I get some sort of article that was written 4 years ago that's out of date. Like the last one I looked at least three of the funds on there, I know haven't raised follow-on funds and are effectively kind of out of play. And I think, you know, if I think about it from my perspective, you know, investor CRM, no brainer at the moment, as an example, you know, in the past I've used HubSpot. Now I use Airtable. I have no inkling as to which is better or worse, but like they're clunky to say the least. Database of investors, again, as I say, makes a huge amount of sense. And then obviously giving those end-to-end tools where it becomes the one place for founders to think about their fundraising requirements takes a lot of the heavy lifting off, right? So even doing the investor updates, which I know as an example is a real drag on my time, like it's a drag on my time in the sense that I love doing them, but finding the time to do them and to make sure that I have the right information and data going out to investors is really critical. And at the moment, again, that may be an email or a Google Doc or a Word document. So I think those are all really compelling. I think the one thing that's probably missing is the financial modeling piece, but that's okay because we've got that. We'll have a chat about that later.
Sure. Yep.
Mm-hmm. But look, there's been a fair flow of capital from the US into the UK and Europe in recent times, certainly over the last couple of years. But for many ventures and founders over here in the UK and this side of the Atlantic, understanding how to enter the US market and critically raising capital from US firms is often a really major factor in their success, because the reality is here, our pockets aren't deep enough, right, to do those larger rounds on an ongoing basis. And obviously the market in the US is bigger, the access to capital is bigger, is easier rather. So what advice would you give to those who are looking to get in front of US investors, other than obviously using Founder Suite? But what are the things you feel are most important to be able to show when you're pitching US firms?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question. There's, on the plus side, I've seen this evolution over the last 5, 10 years, where investors really used to be much more location specific. The old joke was investors, the VCs on Sand Hill Road want to invest in a bicycle ride away from the office or a Tesla charge away from the office. That was the next evolution of that. And I think, you know, we've seen investors become a lot more location agnostic in where they're investing, which is good for European founders, UK founders, everything else. And you're also seeing many Silicon Valley firms open up offices in Europe or UK. And I think that's a sign of that as well. And then you add on the pandemic, where everything was happening over Zoom, and that's really changed the dynamic even more. So it's like, I guess what I'm saying is it's never been a better time for UK entrepreneurs to be raising money from Silicon Valley investors. Now, the bar is still very high. And I think if you're outside Silicon Valley, you know, there's a sort of a higher level of expectations for startups. And that probably means your traction and metrics need to be all that much more exciting, you know, to appeal, right? I think something I did see a lot of startups doing. Now, here in Silicon Valley, there's got to be 30 or 50 of these where there's like Innovation House Norway and Korea House, and like all these countries have an outpost or office in Silicon Valley that's sort of helping foster. There's like the ANZA Tech, which is Australia, New Zealand, right? They're sort of fostering the flow of Australia and New Zealand companies into Silicon Valley. And so I'm sure there's something like that for the UK too. I know there's GABA, German Alliance. I mean, everyone has one. So I'm sure there's one for the UK. So that's something I might plug into early on, kind of see what programs they have. Some of these, like ANZA Tech, the Australian, have programs where they'll take 10, 20 companies from Australia, do the Silicon Valley tour. That's a great way to kind of get your feet wet, learn about the ecosystem. But then another thing I've seen many startups do is either open up an office, just even if it's one person in Silicon Valley, where they put the CEO or CFO, you know, in Silicon Valley, and that person's job is to kind of hustle and network in Silicon Valley. I've seen that, and I've seen also the other variation of that, where maybe that one person coming over from Sweden is here for 3 months, then goes home for 6 months, then comes over for another 3 months, and, you know, really trying to line up lots of meetings during that time, you know, and kind of work the network. So those are a couple ways to kind of cracked the valley without having to move your entire team to the valley. And I think a lot of investors now, like I said, are very open to the Zoom pitch. And so, you know, you could even start off by just trying to have some Zoom meetings, getting the intro if you can, or reaching out cold, like, hey, we're a UK-based startup. This is what we're doing. Here's our pretty exciting, sexy metrics. You know, we're going to be thinking about expanding to the US and Silicon Valley this fall. Can I have a quick conversation to sort of introduce us and pick your brain about a couple things over Zoom now, right? So I think you could even start those conversations well in advance of sending your delegate to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so I really love that. I mean, I'm all about relationships. I mean, I've actually, you know, this podcast is all about building those bridges early on, right? Like getting very, very close to people in various places, whether it's the UK, US, or indeed Europe and Middle East and North Africa. So I think that's a really important, I cannot sort of emphasize enough how important it is for founders to be building those relationships early, whether that's with the US, with us, UK, with us, anywhere. I get really frustrated when I see founders kind of reach out cold to a VC or to multiple VCs, and they're just like, you know, we're raising and our round's closing in the next 30 days, you know, send us some money. When the reality is, you know, why is that VC looking at you or your deck above anyone else? You know, they're getting 3,000 a year or 10,000 a year, whatever the number is. And I think it's really important to build that relationship early on, even if, you know, I've had this where, you know, I have some really strong relationships with VCs. I sent a pre-seed deck out and, you know, got turned down. I wasn't actually looking for VC money, but I wanted some opinions. And, you know, with some really friendly VCs, I was told, yeah, not right now, maybe later. But they still gave me a response and told me why, right? As opposed to necessarily not even answering. So I think that's really important. I think your point around metrics is super important. One of the jokes that kind of goes around, I think, is, you know, in the Valley, they'll fund, you know, a deck and a team. In New York, they'll fund revenue. And in the UK, they'll fund a profit, right? It's not quite as bad as that, I think, but it certainly rings true. The traction needs to be, you know, certainly if you're pitching sort of UK European investors, your traction needs to be that much stronger. I think the reality is, though, if you are pitching US investors, there has to be a demonstrable reason why they would invest in your business as opposed to a US equivalent.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. If they've got deal flow that's coming to them constantly from US-based firms, there needs to be a reason why they would look at a European or a UK business. So, yeah, look, I mean, I think relationship building, absolutely key. And clearly something like Founder Suite, I guess, will give you a bit of an edge as far as that's concerned, because at least you have the information and the knowledge to be able to contact people in advance and start thinking through that. So look, just as we kind of round off, like this pod is called Nothing Ventured, mainly because I'm a great believer and we're great believers in the entrepreneurial spirit, which is arguably far more valued and kind of elevated in the US. I'd love to understand from you how that landscape is changing and whether, you know, in a high interest, high inflation environment like the one we're now in or entering into or maybe in the midst of, who knows, you think it likely that fundraising is going to become harder in the short to midterm? And so, you know, based on that, what would you recommend to entrepreneurs that are struggling to raise right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. You're hearing whispers, you're hearing, you know, headlines on TechCrunch and everything else about how VCs are starting to close their purse strings a little bit, both, you know, because of all the economic factors and interest rates and everything else. So I think there's, and you see that happen every so often. Again, some of those cycles I kind of described at the beginning of this podcast, like for a period of time, investors shut their checkbooks closed pretty aggressively and then, you know, start to crack them open after a few months. We've seen that a few times, but I don't feel like it's there yet. I think things are still the checkbooks are still fairly open, even if VCs have slowed down from the frenetic pace that they've been doing for the past few years. There was a great headline. I actually wasn't able to read it because I don't have a subscription, but headline in New York Times about how people have been predicting the startup bubble to pop for the past 10 years. Like this frenetic activity that's been going on for 10 years, people have been predicting that, you know, to be coming to an end for 10 years. So are we finally seeing that happen? I don't think so yet, knock on wood. But what's the advice for founders on that? I think I'm a sailor and I love sailing. And one of the little metaphors I use is if you're out sailing and the tides change against you and the wind changes direction, you know, what can you do? You can't change the wind direction. You can't change the tides. You can't change the macro environment. All you can do is adjust the trim of your sail to better match that, right? I mean, you maybe adjust your course a little bit. You adjust the angle of your sails to compensate, but you can't change the macro environment. So, you know, I think that's an apt metaphor for founders. If the funding environment is closing a little bit, maybe you don't hire quite as aggressively. You retain a little more cash to be more conservative, you know, to fight and stay another day. But I'm not super negative right now because investors, VCs still have a ton of dry powder of uninvested capital right now, huge record levels of it. So there's still a ton of money out there. And there's been so many VCs that have been formed in the last few years that there's just a ton of money out there. So I'm not super negative right now. I wouldn't, you know, go into the death mode or hibernation mode quite yet. I think maybe just making some slight adjustments, tweaks to your sales.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think for founders, I think there's a couple of things, right? So I think one, the amount of dry powder is really critical. And the fact that there's loads of emerging managers out there, I think is good as well, yes, because obviously they are, you know, they are looking to get into deals which are being overlooked by the bigger players. So there's definitely that kind of capital around there. I think what may be changing is some of the exuberance around, you know, fund anything and everything may start kind of declining a little bit. And there may be a bit of a return back to fundamentals, which, you know, is arguable, is a difficult one to argue because fundamentals in venture, you know, are predicated on there being no fundamentals until quite late in the game. But I think it's really important. I think the message that I took from there is like, you know, the bubble has been bursting for 10 years. Does it mean it's going to burst this year? Probably not, right? Like there is money out there. It is still possible to raise. But I think founders should always be thinking about, you know, what their plan B is if they're not able to raise as quickly as they want to. And I think, you know, one of the things that I certainly advocate for, and, you know, I think a lot of founders make the mistake of ignoring, is just the amount of time it takes a raise, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the sooner you're in a place where you can start having those conversations, even if they're just really gentle kind of introductory conversations, the better place you're going to be when you go out and actually raise down the track. So yeah, I think absolutely you answer the question. I think it's really good to hear, you know, a bit of a positive spin as opposed to a lot of the negativity that comes out of the tech crunch or the press, you know, in general.
I've seen this story multiple times ago. I mean, if you go back and was it Sequoia that came out with their...
The end of...
RIP Good Times. RIP Good Times, Good Times. And that was... And then they had another one, you know, kind of at the beginning of the pandemic, maybe. Kind of these big pronouncements that... Hey, clamp down. And yes, those make great headlines. And there is some element of wisdom to it. But even like during the pandemic, right? Everything shut down March, April, May of 2020. And people were like, the stock market crashed, right? Like, this is it. We're done for. The couple months later, venture market is booming even more than it was before, right? That was just a quick blip. That was a 3-month blip in Q2 of 2020 or Q1, Q2 of 2020, where things shut down and then we're back to boom times like really quickly. So it's hard to really predict the future, but I've seen this story before and the dire headlines make great headlines, but oftentimes it's only a matter of a few months until things are kind of jamming again. So anyway, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, I love ending on positive notes. And on that note, Nathan, I really want to thank you for taking the time to join me on the podcast. It's been absolutely incredible having you here with me today. For our listeners, where can they find you online? Are you on Twitter, LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to look for you?
Yeah, well, obviously FounderSuite is our site, FounderSuite.com. You can create a free account if you want to check it out. We're very active on LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn. Nathan Beckord, Beckord. Love to connect. Maybe mention that you heard about me on the Nothing Ventured podcast, and then I'll connect with you. Happy to connect. We put out a lot of really good content on that, like sample lists of investors or different term sheets or like a lot of really good content on that. So I'd say maybe go to LinkedIn. And then we're also just at FounderSuite on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, so on and so forth. I don't think we have a TikTok presence that I know of, at least.
Give it a quick minute. I'm sure there'll be one pretty soon.
I have a couple interns starting this summer, and so maybe I'll get them going, uh, creating our TikTok presence. I don't know.
Amazing. Nathan, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate it too. This was really fun.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.